Today we're going to go through the department's miscellaneous and technical corrections bill. Senate file 26 or 2869, and then we're going to have a discussion with revenue about the tax expenditure report. So who, Mr. Haugen, who's going to start from the department?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Haugen from the Department of Revenue. I'll be going over Article 1 of the department bill. The bill is pretty predominantly technical corrections, some small substantive changes that we don't think are that controversial, but we've been wrong before. So anyway, I'll start with Article 1. Section 1 deals with the situation where it's a clarification that where you have a unitary group and you spin off, one of the corporations spins out of the unitary group for one reason or another, it clarifies that that spin-off only has to file their return when the unitary group is required to file their return. Section 1 also corrects an incorrect cite to 290.34 to the correct cite 290.017, subdivision 4. That change is also being made in Sections 4 and 5. Section 7, I think there's an amendment to remove that. That would have been another place where we were correcting that that incorrect cite. And we've decided that instead of repealing that rule, we'll do the rulemaking process and change it using that method. Section 2 is also a technical change. It deals with the definition of what a foreign operating corporation is. The current law says that you're a foreign operating corporation if you have $1 million of payroll and $2 million of property. Technically, if you were reading that, if you had $999,000 of payroll or $1,001,000 of payroll, you didn't hit the magic $1 million, so you wouldn't be a foreign operating company. This change just clarifies that what we meant was is that you had to have over those $1 million of payroll and over $2 million of property to qualify for the foreign operating corporation designation. Section 3 is a small substantive change. It deals with the carryover of the R&D credit. The current law says that the R&D credit, the year you generate it, you can use it to offset the regular tax. You can't use it to offset the AMT or the minimum fee. The carryover, on the other hand, for one reason or another, seems to indicate that when you carry it over to the next year, if you don't use it all up, you can use it against the AMT and the minimum fee. This more or less change says that we're going to make those two, the carryover and the generation, consistent, and that they only apply against the regular tax. Section 6 deals with backup withholding for compensation for personal services to an independent contractor when those services are provided to a business. Current law says that if the worker doesn't give you a Social Security number, you have to do backup withholding. That's the same as the federal. We also require backup withholding if we find out that the Social Security number given is not the correct Social Security number. Then after we find that out, the Department of Revenue has to notify the payor that the number is incorrect and you're supposed to do backup withholding. Then there's all kinds of appeal rights. Federally, they do the same thing. If the feds find out that a person has a bad Social Security number, it's somebody else's, they notify the payor, and the payor is required to do backup withholding. What this change would do would say that in the cases where a payor is required to do federal backup withholding, you have to automatically do Minnesota backup withholding as well on that payment for those compensation for personal services. Section 8 is a repeal of a couple obsolete or redundant rules. The first one deals with how we use the concept of gross income in the Minnesota taxes. The old rule refers to some obsolete concepts of income averaging and the farm loss modification that we haven't had for a number of years. The rest of the rule is very clear in the statute and is really not needed any longer, so we're requesting that we repeal that rule. The other rule deals with declarations of estimated tax by corporations for short tax years. There again, it's been a number of years since we've required anybody to file declarations of estimated tax. You just pay the estimated taxes quarterly, and that's all you have to do. That sort of sums up Article 1, and I'll turn it over to Susan Berry of our department to go over the sales tax.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Ms. Berry, if you could state your name for the record, please.
My name is Susan Berry from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll be going through Article 2, Sales and Use Tax. Sections 1, 2, as well as Section 8, together provide that the purchaser shall be relieved from additional liability for tax, penalty, and interest when the purchaser or the purchaser's seller or certified service provider relied on erroneous data provided by the Department of Revenue regarding tax rates, boundaries, taxing jurisdiction assignments, and the taxability matrix. This relief is already provided to the sellers and their certified service providers. Section 3, as well as Sections 10 and 11, amend the sales tax chapter and the sales tax and motor vehicle chapter to update references to the Internal Revenue Code through December 31st, 2007. Section 4 amends the definition of state to include the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and this is in conformity with the streamlined sales tax agreement. Section 5 provides that to the extent a seller under the statute is relieved from liability for accepting a fully completed exemption certificate, so the seller certified service provider is also relieved of liability. Section 6 does two things. First, it clarifies that the exemption for medical devices applies only for human use. Secondly, for durable medical equipment, it provides that the repair and replacement parts that are part of the definition of durable medical equipment includes all components or attachments used in conjunction with the equipment. It also provides that the repair and replacement parts for durable medical equipment do not include those parts which only a single patient can use. Section 7, here the sellers and the certified service providers that have automated systems in place, they rely on the Department of Revenue for each state that they operate in to certify to the accuracy of their systems in regard to the taxability of their product categories. This section provides that if the Minnesota Department of Revenue certifies that the sellers or their certified service provider's automated system accurately captures the taxability of products, then the seller or the certified service provider will not be liable to the state for charging and collecting the incorrect tax. It does limit the extent of the relief by also providing that once the department notifies the seller or the certified service provider that their system is incorrectly classifying a product, they have 10 days to revise their systems. Section 9. This section clarifies that the database files and the taxability matrix that I referred to earlier, that's provided by the department, that sellers and the certified service providers and purchasers can rely on, are those that are specifically required under the streamlined sales tax agreement. And then 10 and 11 was already explained. And I'll turn it over now to Pat Finnegan for the article on special taxes.
Thank
Morning,
you.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Members.
Please state your name for the record, Mr. Finnegan.
My name is Pat Finnegan. I'm an attorney with the Revenue Department. I'll take you through Article 3, the special taxes and fees article. These are all technical amendments. Mr. Chair, Section 1 is dealing with the Electronic Waste Recycling Act, which was enacted last year. And this just clarifies what is meant by various references to the term commissioner. It distinguishes between the revenue commissioner and the pollution control agency commissioner. And then it specifies dates which certain actions have to, by the time which certain actions have to occur. Section 2 is proposing authority to have personal liability for the health impact fee. The distributor pays these fees at the same time in the same manner as the cigarette and tobacco products tax. Sections 3, 4, 5, 8, 11, 12, 14, and 15 are all simply Internal Revenue Code updates in some of the various tax statutes. Sections 6 and 7 deal with the Minnesota care taxes. Section 6 deals with the healthcare provider definition. It clarifies that wholesale drug distributors are excluded from the definition of a health care provider since they are already subject to a Minnesota care tax that is imposed specifically on them. And it also adds a new provision that excludes from health care providers who receive all their payments from other entities that pay tax on the receipts for patient services, and health care providers that receive all their payments from other exempt sources. So the tax would already be paid or be exempt.
Mr. Finnegan, can you give us an example of who they are?
The example that comes to mind is maybe an emergency room doctor who's working as an independent contractor on the weekends or something, where the hospital's already paying the tax, so we wouldn't impose the provider tax on that doctor specifically.
Thank you.
Section 7 is the use tax provision for Minnesota care tax. It clarifies that when no wholesaler is involved, the tax is imposed on costs of the manufacturer to produce the drugs. And I believe there's an amendment related to that section that Senate Counsel put together, and it simply clarifies what we're trying to do there. Section 9 and 10 are petroleum tax provisions. Section 9 is an exemption from the gasoline tax for ethanol when it's transferred between terminals, and Section 10 does the same thing for biodiesel fuel. Section 13 is a cigarette tax contraband provision. Last session, there was a fire retardant law that the fire marshal promoted, and this just clarifies that those cigarettes that aren't in compliance with those standards are contraband. In the statute that was passed last year, it already refers to those cigarettes as being subject to forfeiture. So we're just adding those in our cigarette contraband section. And the last, Section 16, is a healthcare service plan corporation proposal under the insurance premiums tax. And it just repeals a conflicting reference to how those entities are taxed. We've always taxed them at the 1% rate, and there's a conflicting provision that one says 1%, one says 2%. So we're repealing the obsolete provision.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance DeRica. I'll go through Article 4 of the bill. This has to do with property taxes and aides. Sections 1, 2, and 35 update references to the low-income Class 4D property tax classification, the statute that contains requirements from the old Class 4D program to the new. Section 3 fixes the Metro County wheelage tax property tax offsets that are required under current law. I'll mention for staff that I believe the subdivision of statutes that's being amended in this section is being repealed in the tax bill from last year that is back, I believe, on the floor. So we don't want to, it would be nice if we didn't amend that statute after it was repealed. This might need to come out of the bill. Sections 4 through 8, 10 to 14, 23, 26, and 29 update references to the Internal Revenue Code and the United States Housing Act. In the future, we will be able to update references to the Internal Revenue Code by changing one statute instead of all of these variety of ones. Section 9 makes a change to the exemption date, the date for determining exemptions in the case of manufactured homes and park trailers, travel trailers that are taxed as personal property. Sections 15 to 22 make clarifications and corrections to the laws that were enacted in the special session of 2007 to deal with disasters and vandalism. Sections 33, 36, and 37 update some cross-references to those statutes because we replaced the old abatement and credit program in the case of disasters with a new set of statutes. Section 24 merely clarifies that if a person submits a copy of their Schedule F from their federal income tax return in support of their homestead classification claim, that will be protected data. 25 makes kind of a complicated change for homesteads that are held under a trust. In the case of the property being rented to an authorized farming corporation, the change is technical to make anyone who is a member of that authorized farming entity eligible. The property will be eligible for homestead if any member of that entity actively farms it. This makes the law consistent with another section that provides a homestead in the same kind of situations for non-trust held property. Section 27 makes uniform the language dealing with the benefits that a homestead gets if it's occupied by a blind person, a disabled person, or a disabled veteran. And again, the disabled veteran language is being changed by another bill, but in the meantime, what this law provides is if you're a blind person, you get 100% of the benefit, even if your spouse is not blind. With the other two, the disabled and disabled veterans, the way it's worded, you get a half homestead if you're disabled but your spouse isn't. We're making that the same for all three. They all would get 100% of this benefit, even if both spouses don't have the condition. Sections 28 and 30 have to do with a rural land classification that staff has been working on, and the department is working with the local assessors for about the last year or so, where the in areas of the state where the use is going from predominantly agricultural to recreational, helps us deal with those situations. Sections 31 and 32 cover the situation where a local board of review loses the power to meet because it didn't have a quorum or the members didn't have training. This merely clarifies that they do not lose the ability to have a local assessment. Section 34 would classify the income information that we get from people who apply for the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program, classify that as private data. Sections 38 and 39 have to do with local government aid. There's a couple of offsets to the appropriation in statute. The appropriation for local government is made, local government aid is made, and then the statute requires us to offset that appropriation with some costs. As far as we've been able to determine, those offsets stay in the general fund. So what we're proposing here is to reduce, instead of taking two steps where one amount is appropriated, then reduced, we would just enact the reduced amount. We do not believe this has any impact on the general fund. And that is Article 4.
Thank you, Mr. Sturica. Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll go through Article 5. Article 5 relates primarily to Job Z, the revisions of the clawback provisions in the Job Z law. Under Job Z laws, businesses are entitled to various income, corporate, sales, and property taxes for operating in a job zone. As a condition of eligibility for those benefits, they're required to sign a business subsidy agreement in which they commit to a certain level of capital investment, job creation, job retention, and wage goals. There are consequences if the business does not live up to its obligations. Those are administered by the Department of Revenue. Generally, they're required to pay 2 years' worth of Job Z tax benefits that they've already received, and then they'd no longer be eligible for future benefits. These changes that we're proposing make clear who is subject to the clawback, also make clear what taxes have to be repaid, also make clear that there's no ability to claim benefits after they've been in violation of their agreement. It also contains a reporting requirement that should make it easier for revenue to learn that a business is no longer eligible to participate in the Job Z program. For the most part, these changes do address some of the concerns raised in the legislative audit report. Section 1 amends the current clawback statute in a number of ways, the most significant of which is that businesses that are still operating in the job zone but in violation of their business subsidy agreement are no longer subject to the repayment provisions of this section. They're subject to other consequences that I'll get to later. The section also clarifies that the Job Z clawback applies to owners of zoned property that is leased by a Job Z business. These are generally the landlords that are receiving exemptions for rental income and property tax exemptions. Although subject to clawback, if the operating business closes down, the clawback will be waived if the property owner wasn't in any way responsible for the business stopping operations in the zone. Additionally, this section clarifies the two-year clawback period. That for sales tax, it starts with for sales purchases made before the business closes down. And for income tax, it's the 2 years prior to the closure. And for property taxes, there's a clawback for the year of closure and the prior year. Additionally, it clarifies that the business is not subject to any benefits for periods after the clawback kicks in. Now, Section 2 is the new consequence for those businesses that continue to operate in the zone but in violation of their business subsidy agreement. These are situations where a business might promise 30 jobs and deliver 25. Under current law, what happens is that they would then be subject to clawback of 2 years' worth of benefits and receive no future benefits, subject to a possibility of waiver of those benefits with the commissioner. What this is doing is changing that by saying that there's no clawback of the benefits that they've already received. However, there's no future benefits unless they sign a new business subsidy agreement. And the new business subsidy agreement can only be signed after the commissioner of deed reduces the zone duration, taking away at least 1 year benefit, but the zone duration will be decreased based on the level of partial performance that they've had under the original business subsidy agreement.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, is that a little harsh? I mean, if they're having economic difficulty, can they modify their agreement instead of have the penalties imposed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson. Well, under current law, they can request the waiver. Well, that's one of the reasons we're coming forward with this, is that it seems awfully harsh that under current law, what happens is that the business potentially comes into a zone expecting 10 or 12 years' worth of benefits, and they end up missing their goals by 10 or 20%. And what happens is that potentially they lose 100% of their expected benefits. So what we've come forward with is something that they don't have the problem. A lot of times when they're missing their goals, there's something going on then, so it makes it very difficult for them to actually be able to afford to repay 2 years' worth of tax benefits. Going forward could be potentially devastating, but we believe there's got to be some consequence, so we're taking it off at the end of the zone duration, which is farthest out. What we're doing is taking away discretion to come up with a remedy and saying this is how clawback will work or the consequences will work.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. So the way I was perceiving it is exactly the opposite. You're giving them – do they always have the ability to modify the agreement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson. We're proposing that they never have the ability to modify the agreement, at least not to get out of clawback situations. We were very concerned that some businesses – and some communities were looking at situations where they had created, they promised 20 jobs, and they had to do it by the end of next month. And they were saying, well, we're gonna avoid any clawback issues by amending or signing a new agreement that says we only have to deliver 15, which just happened to be how many they'd had. So, in consultation with our friends at Deed, we didn't think that was a good idea. So I think the answer is we don't want them to be able to amend that business subsidy agreement. Now, if in fact they're still operating in the zone and at the two-year period that they generally have to create those jobs, they have not created them and they're subject to the clawback, under our proposal, they could then amend the agreement going forward so that, to a more realistic number to continue to receive the benefits.
Mr. Peterson, have we ever clawed back any benefits?
Mr. Chairman, we've had I know of at least one business that is repaid. Now we've spent some time trying. We have a list of maybe, 25, 35 A couple of them have come forward and asked for waivers that were granted. We have spent considerable time trying to identify how much tax benefits some of these have. Some of them have almost none, if none. We're in the process of trying to assess them, and that's what the law says. They don't voluntarily repay. We have the ability to issue orders and assess tax, assess the clawback.
Or you have the department has the authority to waive the clawback.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And after all of these revisions, is the department still going to have the authority to waive the clawback?
Mr. Chairman, the department will have the ability to waive the clawback in those situations where the business has closed down. In those situations where the business hasn't closed down, but they're continuing to operate in violation of the business subsidy agreement, there really isn't any clawback. There's no repayment. The consequence is to take a year or two or three off at the end. And the laws, the bill's drafted so that that's not negotiable, that's not waivable, that can't be revised. Once that decision to reduce the zone duration by a year or two or three,
but then we lay it on
once that's made, that can't be undone.
Thank you.
Section 3 is what I just mentioned, which would be a prohibition against amending the business subsidy agreement to avoid clawback. Section 4 addresses a concern that's taking too long for revenue to learn of business subsidy agreement violators. What it would do would be to require each business to send a certification to Deed that by December 1 of each year that they're in compliance with their business subsidy agreement. The penalty for failing to do that is that the business would be clawed back. There'd be a two-year repayment that would kick in immediately. Which for those businesses that have closed down isn't really a consequence, but it makes sure that we know that they're no longer operating. For those businesses, though, that promised the 30 and only delivered 20, that's a really big consequence because otherwise they'd have just had the zone duration shortened under the proposal I just talked about. So it's a really harsh penalty for not sending it in, and to make sure that this doesn't just happen accidentally, we make sure that before this consequence can kick in, the local economic development folks are going to be given an opportunity to notify the business. Indeed, we'll also notify the business a second time saying, we're really serious about this. You need to get this in. So that's all I have.
Thank you.
My name is Joan Tuich. I'm with the department, and I'll be going over Article 6 of the department bill, the miscellaneous provisions. Section 1 and 2 of the bill would allow cities and counties to refer debts to the commissioner for collection, and it also clarifies that state-supported schools, in addition to the U of M, may refer debts to the commissioner for collection. Section 3 would allow the commissioner, rather than the referring agency, to determine whether a debt that has been referred for collection is uncollectible. And Section 4 changes the revenue recapture provisions relating to debtor notification when a claim is initially entered into the revenue recapture system. The statute currently provides that if a notice is returned to the claimant agency, then they must obtain the current address from the commissioner and resend the notice. This amendment changes the current language to the last known address because this is the best address that the commissioner has, and also it's the address currently used in the tax collection provisions in Chapter 16D and 270C. And then finally, Section 5 clarifies that the prohibition against collection during the appeal period of an order will generally apply to all orders of assessment where liability is being imposed, not just orders of assessment as currently provided. This is needed because some language was inadvertently dropped during the recodification of 270C, and this just puts it back the way it should be. And that's Article 6.
Any questions, members? Thank you very much. Members, we have a small technical amendment, the A1. Thank you. 2. The A1 amendment, Council.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is something that I just want to clarify, basically clarify the difference in that sentence, so that it does express the intent that the person who is not a manufacturer will be subject to use tax under the minimum.
The A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. The A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment deletes one of the rule-changing provisions in Section 7. Apparently, the department change for right now. It relates to the corporate income tax and filing of combined signatory groups.
On the A2 amendment to delete Section 7 on page 8. Any
Chair,
discussion? Senator Limmer.
Why are we doing this?
Mr. Chair, this section creates a new rule change. It requires the commissioners to amend the current rule, and the department is not prepared to do that rule change.
Any other discussion? Not on the A2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Are there, Councilor, are there any other rule changes in here? Is there any reason this bill has to go anywhere because of rulemaking authority?
I don't
Members, I don't believe this bill needs to go anywhere. Judiciary has already looked at the data collection information in here. Apparently, there's no other rule authority granted to the department, so there's no reason for state and local to see it. So, Chair lays over Senate file 2869 for further consideration.
I had one question I wanted to ask.
Sure.
If I could direct your attention to page 68, that's Article 6, the first section. And that talks about the commissioner now having an expanded authority to collect debt. And I see that we're expanding that debt collection for local units of government, Minnesota colleges and universities. Apparently, we do that for the court system, according to the original language. But I was wondering, if there's an expense, who pays for that expense? Do the political subdivisions that are mentioned here, do they pay for the expense? Are they billed by the commissioner? How does that work?
Yes, I'm Joan Tuich with the department. Generally, there's collection costs that are added to the debt and collected from the debtor.
So ultimately, Mr. Chair, that debtor...
That's
he's
going
right. to pay not only for his past debts, but he has to pay for the collection service as well.
Right.
Why do we need the power of the state government now to do this? How does it work now?
How does the local governments collect their debts?
Right.
They would have to rely on their own resources to collect. Mm-hmm. Where under the state collection remedies, we have some additional resources that we can use. You know, liens and levies, which they could do, but our system is more streamlined, and, you know, the cities and counties would not be required to submit debts to us for collection. It would be a negotiated contract with the collection division and the department, and we would do, you know, what we had agreed to with the local government. You know, various governments would want us to do You know, some we would file revenue recapture claims for them. Some of them, you know, we would collect debts of a certain amount.
Is there a, Mr. Chair, is this a big problem in collecting debts by the by these other units, local government units or colleges and universities?
Well, they have approached us and, you know, requested that we work with them, and we haven't been able to do that or even institute a pilot program because we don't have the authority. So initially we would just like to, you know, maybe start a pilot program, work with a couple of the, you know, local governments who have indicated an interest in the past and, you know, see how it works. I know there's also a legislative study, I believe, or a study that Collections did that asked us to look at this option.
Mr. Lemmer.
I don't know if local governments or, for that matter, colleges or universities, if there was a debt that needed to be paid, can they hold back or restrict the use of a professional license like the state does in collecting its debt? Can they impose that same requirement or sanction against someone?
Themselves?
Right.
I do not think so, but I can check on that and get back to you for
And
sure.
In the event that the state takes over that responsibility, can the state then exact that sanction in collecting a debt, such as pulling a professional license in order to affect the debt of a university or a college or a political subdivision?
Mr. Chair, my name is Wayne Sather. Am I understanding that you're asking if the colleges and universities can hold licenses back themselves? The state can for taxes. I'm not quite sure.
The question, Mr. Chair, that I'm getting at is if we allow the state to manage this debt collection, and if that debt collection is not done, would that trigger the state's authority to withhold someone's professional license for a debt that might be owed to a college or a university? Are we going to release that authority in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the license clearance power is not one of the ones that's delegated to debt collection of non-tax debt.
All right. Okay.
Anything else, members? Not. Thank you. We will move on to the tax incidents report. I think, members, if you didn't take it home, you should have a copy. Does anybody not have a copy with them? We supplied them earlier on. Mr. Lemmer, you were given a homework assignment to take it home and take a look at it and see if you could find any way to help Senator Cohen with the budget deficit.
Mr. Chair, all of this is on an internet file. And I have that at home.
And that's where you reviewed it.
Mr. Chair, I'm just saying that's it's at home.
Mr. Chair, I slipped mine under my pillow.
But Mr. Wilson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Wilson from the Tax Research Division of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. With me, joining me at the table today is Rod Hoheisel, who is Assistant Director of the Tax Research Division at the Department of Revenue. We appreciate the opportunity to provide a brief overview of the tax expenditure budget for you. At the federal level, the tax expenditure budget was a product of a very large budget reform act in 1974. The 1974 Budget Act created the Congressional Budget Office and also created the federal tax expenditure budget. The goal was to try to bring tax expenditures into the regular budgetary process so they would receive the same scrutiny as direct expenditures. 9 years later, in 1983, the Minnesota legislature required a similar study to be released in produced in Minnesota. This is the 11th Minnesota tax expenditure budget, produced by about a dozen members of our staff over a period of several months under the direction of supervision of Carolyn Carlson in our office. I'm going to let Rod Hoheisel begin the presentation, and I'll come in later and be here to answer questions.
start with some background points. The tax expenditure budget is a legislative mandate.
Could we please have your name for the record?
My name is Rod Hoheisel, Revenue Tax Research.
Thank you. This
report is updated every 2 years, and it's due February 1st of each even-numbered year. The first study was done back in 1985, and as Paul mentioned, this is the 11th edition that has been produced. The taxes that are included, as you see, cover the income taxes, both individual and corporate, general sales tax, motor vehicle sales tax, many of the special taxes we have, including state taxes, excise taxes on alcohol and cigarettes, mortgage and deed, gambling taxes, motor vehicle registration, and so forth. And it also includes the local property tax. Looking at the main purposes for the report, a couple of points. First of all, the report identifies tax provisions that reduce revenue. And those provisions generally are either tax exemptions, deductions, tax credits, or lower rates in certain cases. Also, the report recognizes that tax expenditures are very similar to direct expenditures or appropriations in that they encourage specific activities or assist certain people, businesses, or groups. And an example of that to point to might be the corporate R&D credit, which is intended to promote or encourage R&D spending in Minnesota. Finally, the report helps to facilitate a regular review of tax expenditures. And for states that don't have a report such as this, it's likely that tax expenditures are generally not reviewed every biennium. I'd like to mention a couple other points about the similarities between direct expenditures or appropriations and tax expenditures. And in some sense, they can be looked at as alternative means to reach the same public policy goals. Examples shown up there are areas of child care, economic development incentives, low-income assistance, where, for example, income tax credits like the Child Independent Care Credit or the Working Family Credit provide very similar benefits to direct assistance programs in these cases. Also, the last point there, both direct expenditures and tax expenditures have fiscal costs. They need to be defined in terms of who is eligible for each program and have administrative costs. And I think we could say that we're not always clear as tax administrators which method, program administration, compared to having a tax credit in the tax system, which is more efficient. In terms of definition of tax expenditure, a provision is a tax expenditure only if they meet certain defined criteria. First, provisions must provide or give preferential treatment. So there are certain items, such as the standard deduction in the income tax or dependent or personal exemptions, that are not considered tax expenditures because everyone benefits from them. They apply to everyone. Secondly, tax expenditures must have a revenue impact. So in a couple cases, such as the International Economic Development Zone area, those are not considered tax expenditures because there is no revenue impact that we see in the defined time frame of the study, which is fiscal 08 through fiscal 011. It's a tax expenditure only if these provisions are not subject to an alternative tax. So, for example, this would exclude sales tax exemption for motor vehicles because motor vehicles are subject to tax under the motor vehicle sales tax. Also, direct items or provisions, areas that are considered direct expenditures, such as the property tax refund program amounts or political contribution refunds, are not counted as tax expenditures. Finally, in regards to tax expenditures, it's a tax expenditure only if the legislature has authority over imposing a tax or making changes. So this excludes the income tax exemption for federal bond interest, which is has a federal preclusion to it. The report, for those who may want to look at it, contains quite a bit of other information. The history for each tax is explained, including the date enacted, the date last changed. There is an overview of how each tax is computed, there's a description of each tax expenditure provision, a statutory citation, and then after the analysis is done, the fiscal impact for the 4 years that we show is listed. And we're available. We also show the number of taxpayers who benefit from each provision. One point that we would like to make is that tax expenditure estimates are not always the same as revenue estimates. Tax expenditure estimates assume no change in taxpayer behavior. They're estimated in isolation, or each is taken as a separate case. So you could have a situation where if you repeal two tax expenditures that overlap, their actual revenue impact can be different from the sum of the two tax expenditure estimates. And a final point we'd make is that because the project is done over several months, the estimates in our report really are benchmarked to the November forecast. So with the recent forecast or a year later, they're out of date to the extent that there is an updated forecast base.
Mr. Chair, as we noted, this is the 11th study, 11th edition of the tax expenditure budget. And to look at some of that history, it's somewhat useful to look back and see how things have changed through time. One way to do that is just to look at the counts of tax expenditures through time, how many items are actually listed in the booklet. And if we look at that from 239 in the first study, 1985, you see some growth. We'll look at the individual tax types are going to show more, actually, than this does. I would say, though, that there always are questions about at the margins about what's in and what's out. And as the first bullet there mentions, the decline from 299 to 293 in 2008 is somewhat misleading. We actually removed five tax expenditures because when we looked at them more carefully, and we've considered this for a while, we thought those were not really tax expenditures by the definition. They all involved a tax credit for taxes paid to another state. That is part of the basic structure of state income taxes now. And so in some sense, you ought to look at that as a drop from 299 to 298, maybe just a drop of one, if we hadn't taken out those five for definitional reasons. The counts also ignore expansion of existing items. You can obviously have an expansion of a tax expenditure. When we added the tax exemption for non-prescription drugs, that did not add a tax expenditure to our book because it was just included with other drugs. And obviously, if you expand the, if you speed up the move towards single sales apportionment and the corporate income tax, that makes that a more expensive tax expenditure, but it doesn't add one to the book. So counts are somewhat misleading. Nevertheless, there is some benefit to looking at counts by tax type, at least. For the income tax, you see an abrupt drop between 1987 and 1989. That is the major income tax reform, the federal income tax reform of 1988, and then Minnesota piggybacked on that reform, made major changes in the income tax. And the number of tax expenditures dropped by a lot in that year. You can see that the number of tax expenditures has grown since then. Tax expenditures come, you know, we have new ones and we have old ones expiring and leaving the system. So there's quite a bit of noise in some of these tax types. There are 10 existing tax expenditures in the latest study that did not exist in the 2000 study. And yet we are basically, fairly close to being level with that study. So we do have some that expire, some that disappear from the system. The other thing to note with the income tax is that of the 86 tax expenditures in the 2008 study, 66 are basically federal income tax deductions or federal income tax exemptions. When we start the income tax in Minnesota with federal taxable income, we pick up a lot of the federal tax expenditures. In the book, they're all listed first. All the federal ones are basically listed first, and then the Minnesota tax expenditures that are added on after that are added later. It doesn't mean you can't change a federal tax expenditure. Obviously, we could deny something that the feds allow as a deduction, but I think it helps to think about organizing the book in that way to list those first. Sales and use tax, you see a quite different pattern, simply a steady increase in tax expenditures. The sales and use tax, there are 14 new expenditures since the 2000, I'm sorry, 14 tax studies were added since the 2000 study, even though you don't see much of a growth there. So some of the sales tax expenditures, if you look in the book, are construction exemptions, which are temporary because once the construction is completed, they disappear. So there's actually more fluidity, if you like, more movement in and out of the books if you look at the history. And again, the point here is just that it's hard to, the counts don't tell everything because of expansions of various ones. But still, you can see the different pattern here compared to the income tax. The corporate tax is again, illustrates how you don't want to discount these things necessarily because in 2001, one large tax expenditure replaced nine smaller ones in the insurance area. Basically, with a change in law that essentially said just exempt everybody instead of these various categories, subcategories. And as a result, the drop between 2000 and 2002 from 43 to 35 is largely a creation of that artificial change in the way these counts are done. Again, in 2008, 36 of the ones listed, of the 36 listed, 21 are federal tax expenditures. We again start with federal definitions of income to a large extent. And six existing tax expenditures now have been added since the 2000 study. We also can look at the dollar amounts. Now, as Rod Hoheisel mentioned, we're hesitant to add the dollar amounts up. Okay, I mean, that's another way to do these. But these are not additive. So just simply adding the dollar amounts up in the book can be misleading. That wouldn't keep you from doing it, but there's a little problem with us presenting totals because the total dollar amount from all of them is not necessarily what would happen if you got rid of all of them because of the interaction between them. Nevertheless, we can look at the list of the larger ones as helpful in the income tax. The ones with asterisks here all are federal provisions. You'll notice the only large one on here that's not a federal provision is the working family credit. The others are at least piggybacked on federal rules. You can see the importance of fringe benefits, both medical insurance and pension contributions. And at the bottom, I show the forecast revenue for fiscal year 2009, the February forecast. If you were to simply add up what's on this page, again, I caution against doing that, but if you were to do that, you'd get about $3.8 billion, which compares to $7.7 or $7.8 billion. So the tax expenditures obviously are large compared to the tax base that remains in the system. General sales tax, of course, we have no federal tax to piggyback on, so none of these are federal provisions. There's a blank at the top, and I apologize for that. Selected services, if you look at the book, you'll notice there's a blank page, and this was pointed out on the cover of the edition. We use a consumption tax model, input-output model, to try to estimate the impact of a lot of the services that have business components to them. That model was being updated by a contractor, and we have run into problems with contract. As of yesterday, we finally have the updated model, and within a few days, we hope to be able to get you the numbers for those services. I had hoped to be able to just hand them to you today, but it did not happen. We still have some questions about what the model is showing. The selected services in this case include things like legal and accounting services, other professional services, business services at various sites, sources such as personnel costs, some administrative services costs. Auto repair is in there as well as personal services. The total is about $2 billion. It's by far the largest category because it's made up of a lot of separate services. In the sales tax, services are exempt unless they are brought into the system. Goods are taxable unless they are taken out of the tax base. So services basically are exempt. Anyway, I do apologize for the list. Again, if you look at the total here, you'll see that in the sales tax, if you just added up the numbers here, including the selected services number, you'd get a number about equivalent to the forecast revenue for those. And again, you can look at some of the larger numbers in these cases. Corporate tax, the largest expenditures are shown here as well. Again, the corporate tax expenditures, if you simply add, there's a lot of interaction between some of these, so this is where this is where there's the greatest danger adding up the numbers, but still, the tax expenditures are relatively large compared to the forecast collections in this case as well. That Basically, when we present the tax expenditure budget, we do view it as a useful tool for you to use in sort of reviewing tax expenditures, for looking at how best to administer programs to provide assistance to specific groups. There are some real questions at the border of how you define tax expenditures, and we can certainly address those questions if you have issues with that. We'll certainly respond to questions that you have.
Mr. Wilson, the deduction for home mortgage interest, is there any way to break out how much of that home mortgage interest deduction is on second homes versus on primary homesteads?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'm certain there is a way to do it. It's not an easy way. In other words, you can't just look at the tax returns and see that. There were some limitations proposed in some past years. The one thing I would say is that if you have a first home and you have equity in your first home, if we denied the deduction to the second home, you could take out a larger mortgage on your first home and pay off your mortgage on the second, and that interest would then be, you can somewhat, to some extent, play with the mortgage interest deduction that way. But there would be, probably is a way to get that. I don't know of any work that's been done on that. But
in the first home, the mortgage interest is deductible up to $1 million mortgage. Is that what I remember? So, there is a cap on how much of a mortgage you can carry and still have the interest deductible, is there not?
I believe that's the case, yes. Yeah, it's on page 59 in the report, and it's interest ducked up to $1 million of debt used to pay. So not $1 million of interest, but $1 million of debt used to for the house.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. on one of the slides, about three or four back, you had a reference to independent retirement accounts or individual retirement accounts, and there was a cost there that was recognized, and I was wondering if that's a recognition of the dollar amount, a percentage of the dollar amount that's invested in IRAs, or is it a potential that could be recognized? Is it an actual?
The IRAs, obviously, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, IRAs obviously come in different forms. Some of them have a deduction up front. They all allow you to earn interest within the account without paying tax on an ongoing basis. At the end, in some cases, with the old-fashioned IRAs, you pay tax when you take the money out. With the Roth, it's done in the reverse way. So there are a variety. The tax expenditure is an attempt to look at the net impact compared to you're basically compared to not having the special rules for IRAs. And anything like that, including depreciation, where you have this pattern through time where you're actually getting some money back. I mean, some people are paying tax on the IRAs now. It's a net impact. It's quite different from what a revenue estimate would be in some of these cases. So any of these that have timing issues like that, if you wanted to look at doing something, you really need a revenue estimate rather than this number. Because this is sort of a steady state number, ongoing, how much more are we getting this year than we would if we just had taxed this as normal income.
And Mr. Chair, is that a blurring of a Roth-type IRA and a regular IRA? Is that figure that you've depicted on the slide, is that a blurring of that? And is there a way to get a breakdown on those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it certainly is a blurring of the two, and again, I don't know of anywhere we can look at that right away, but we could certainly look at that. I mean, that's the kind of analysis that breaks down quite a bit finer detail. But Certainly the Roth, most Roth IRAs, are not. It's not an old enough thing yet to have. All we'd have is the interest building up without tax. We wouldn't have much of that income being you know, that's basically what the Roth does, gives you. It gives you the build-up, tax-free build-up of interest.
And, Mr. Chair, there was also a reference to foreign-owned corporations, and below that line there was a foreign royalty source. And I was wondering, could you tell me what a foreign royalty source is? That's a term that I'm not familiar with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, we in the corporate tax, and there is someone here from the legal staff who may bail me out if I mislead this, and I'm sure he'll come up if I say something that's earlier. Basically, the foreign operating corporation provision is a provision where you have a deemed dividend, so it's actually part of the dividends received deduction. I mean, it plays in that way. That's separate from the royalties deduction, foreign royalties deduction. They're actually two completely separate provisions. There is an interaction between the two if you do revenue estimates for them, but they are two different provisions, completely separate in terms of the tax form and the way they enter the tax. So you should look at them as completely separate ideas, foreign royalties deduction and the deemed dividend for foreign operating corporations.
Okay.
And they're just shown completely separate.
I'm still not sure if I know what the difference is between the two, but there's another person at this table.
Yeah.
Could you?
Mr. Chair, my name is Stephen Krenkel. I'm with the Department of Revenue. What it is, there are two distinct. One is a subtraction of foreign royalties, fees, and other like income, and that's a subtraction from income. 80% of the royalties, fees, and other like income received by a corporation that's subject to Minnesota tax from a foreign corporation or a foreign operating corporation. So that's a royalty fee and other like income subtraction. The foreign operating corporation itself receives a deduction, or rather doesn't receive a deduction. It's not subject to tax. It doesn't file a return. It is a corporation that is required to have $2 million worth of property, $1 million worth of payroll, and 80% of that has to be outside of the United States, basically. It's got a technical definition of what's a state and this sort of thing. But for the purposes of this discussion, just understand that 80% of its property and payroll have to be outside of the United States. The net income of that foreign operating corporation, and it's got to be a domestic corporation part of a unitary group. The net income of that foreign operating corporation is a deemed dividend to its parent corporation, which is subject to Minnesota tax. But that deemed dividend qualifies for the dividend received deduction under Minnesota Statutes 290.21. So that income is taxed at 20%, basically, because it receives the 80% deduction.
Is that a flatline 20%, or is that a progressive tax structure that goes up to 20%?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is a dividend received deduction, so it is 80% of the dividends are deducted in computing the net income of the taxpayer.
All right.
So that's the royalty subtraction?
I beg your pardon?
Is that their subtraction? The 80% is the subtraction.
Mr. Chair, the 80% is a dividend received deduction. It is also 80% on the subtraction side. They are two separate provisions, but they are both fixed at 80%.
And, Mr. Krenkel, why not 70?
Mr. Chair, that's a legislative call. As a matter of fact, I've seen proposals that would limit the subtraction in its scope but raise the amount to 90%. So you could set it at any amount you wish. That's a legislative a matter of legislative choice.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, you spoke earlier about how it's hard to just simply add up the numbers because of the interaction of the credits and deductions, which is very intuitive, of course. I think every credit or deduction is designed to cause some other action or behavior. How easy is it to track, the interaction? You know, for example, it's pretty easy to understand that, if the home interest tax deduction were eliminated, there'd be fewer people would buy homes, or if the child care credit were eliminated, fewer people would have jobs and there'd be less income tax, for example, and frankly more subscription to social services. You know, the impact on property tax from the failure to buy homes is easy, but across the board, you know, across all of these various credits and deductions, do we have a pretty good idea of what we hope to occur as a result, and you know, whether it be some sort of economic activity that creates taxes in another realm? Is that really easy or really hard? or does it depend?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I think what the interaction you're talking about is a little different than what I was actually meaning on the slide. There is this effect. If you give the home mortgage interest obviously does encourage home ownership, and so there is, you know, there's an effect on home ownership rather relative to renting, presumably because of that. And that's more of a sort of secondary effect, and that's not really taken into account. I mean, we're looking at just running the model and seeing what the cost is if you had the same number of homeowners and you just got rid of the deduction. So that's one kind of interaction. But what we were talking about more was if you got rid of the home mortgage interest deduction, you'd raise a certain amount of money. I mean, if we just got rid of it and left everything the same, we'd raise a certain amount of money, which is sort of the kind of estimate that's in here. What if you, at the same time as you did that, though, you got rid of the deduction for charitable contributions? Not that anybody's going to do this, but if you did that, when you get rid of the, when you put them on top of each other, you're actually going to raise more money by getting rid of both of them than you would by the sum of the two if you did them separately, because you're going to end up pushing people into higher tax brackets, pushing more income into the tax system. And it's that kind of interaction where you sort of get multiplicative effects. In other cases, in the sales tax area, you've got an exemption for food. You've also got an exemption for schools. Now, some of what's exempted at schools is food. When the estimates are done, we do the food estimate, assuming the school exemption is still there. And so if you got rid of both of them, you'd have a different – and when you do the school one, you assume the food exemption is still there. So to some extent, there's an interaction between the two as well. But the bigger question you raise of sort of the actual economic effect of these is not really addressed in the study, because when we go in to look at the home mortgage, we don't try to estimate what the impact of that is all the way through the economy. We just run the HITS model and say, what happens if kind of what do we get rid of this one deduction? What's the impact of that?
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Olson, who would we ask for that analysis if we were considering any changes to deductions and credits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, presumably you would ask us. But in some cases, there are situations where in certain tax expenditures, the person that would know better what the impact of something would be someone in a different department. If it affects health care, then the health economics group at the Department of Health is probably, we would turn to them or work with them. Certainly for some of the others, economic development incentives, again, working with folks at DEED to try to figure out what they can tell us. But you know, if those kind of questions arise, they would be directed at us, and we would do the best we can to answer.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, just one further comment. In some selected cases, if there's a major economic impact, the Department of Finance may take it into account separately as an economic change to the forecast.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wilson, I have a couple questions with the interaction between accelerated depreciation and the expensing depreciable business property. That was Section 179. And are we in fully in compliance with the federal code on accelerated depreciation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, the term, and I think the short answer is no, but the term federal conformity can be used in different ways. When we a bill that's being considered this year to conform to federal law, a bill which I don't know that, I think you may have heard that, I'm not clear, but the bill that conforms to federal law in the income tax would conform in terms of agreeing to the definition of adjusted gross income and other things, but on expensing and on the bonus depreciation, I believe the proposal is an 80% add back, and then subtract it over the next 5 years. And that's conformity in the sense that it gets our definitions of a starting point together. but it certainly doesn't do the same thing for the taxpayer as conformity, meaning you get to take the full deduction, the full expensing in the first year for bonus depreciation. 179, we're even further out of conformity if you talk about what the benefits are to the taxpayer of the federal law versus us. So our attempt to conform in those cases is an attempt to conform in a way that would simplify filing and record keeping for the taxpayer, but really doesn't give the taxpayer the benefits that would flow through from a complete conformity. So I hope that's not too confusing, but when we say we conform to the federal law, we're sort of conforming for purposes of
taxpayers,
of adjusted gross income and other provisions, but we don't necessarily conform on either expensing or bonus depreciation in a way that looks the same to the taxpayer.
And so,
sir,
Mr. Chair, so the taxpayer isn't having to do any changes on the Minnesota form for the accelerated depreciation, but on the expensing depreciable business property, they have to add back 80% of what they are expensing on their federal income tax on the Minnesota form?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, that's correct. On accelerated depreciation, there's been no change in the general one, but the expensing is where there's been the change. And then bonus depreciation also is part, I think, of the accelerated depreciation piece, so that piece of it you have to add back as well.
And, Mr. Chair, the interaction between the two then, if we were 100, you know, if on 179, if we didn't ask them to add back that 80%, those dollars then just flow out of 09, 010, 011, 012 and go to 08? Or how does that work? What's the interaction between the two?
Yeah, if you take expensing up front, you have less depreciation to take later, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you are all of the depreciation and the expensing and the bonus depreciation, all of them are simply changing the timing of your deductions. Mm-hmm. They're moving them forward. So more is deducted now, less will be deducted later. If you look over the lifetime of the asset, the same amount of deductions are given. They're just given at an earlier time. The lifetime of these assets is long enough, though, that for our budget period, it can be a very large hit in the first year or two if we were to fully conform. But the bonus depreciation part of it is showing up in the accelerated depreciation numbers. The expensing, the 179, is separate and showing in the expensing numbers.
And so, Mr. Chair, then the reverse would be true. If we had them add back 100%, that would just move the number here that's in 2008 and put it in 9, 10, 11, 12, and whatever the depreciation schedule is.
Mr. Chair, sorry, to some extent that's right. These numbers in the tax management booklet are sort of our net numbers, looking at accelerated depreciation and things in the past years, too. So you sort of have an ongoing process of allocation. But if you were to make those changes, you would be shifting. You'd be shifting the cost in that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Wilson, on the expenditure where we don't tax interest on state and local bonds, is there any evidence to show that by doing that, state and local government actually get a preferential interest rate on those bonds? I mean, that would be the only argument to do it, I think. Do we think we do compared to other bonds out there?
Mr. Chair, there is a differential rate holding constant for risk. There's a differential rate for tax-exempt bonds, certainly relative to taxable bonds. I think the question that most analysts have looked at in terms of tax-exempt bonds is whether the interest differential, how large that is relative to the amount of money that the state would forego in tax. There certainly is a differential. I mean, this does, in fact, it does pass a benefit along to the borrower. They do pay a lower interest rate. But there have been studies that try to look at their interest savings and compare it to the loss in tax revenue to the state. And those studies usually show that the gain to the local government is smaller than the loss to the state. And in that sense, sometimes referred to as an inefficient subsidy. I can't quote you the study specifically, but I think that's the question. I don't think there's any question that local governments do benefit somewhat from lower interest rates when it's tax exempt.
And Dr. Wilson, the rationale that insurance companies aren't subject to the corporate franchise tax. And what year was that done?
I believe that was, Mr. Chair, I believe that was 2001 when that exemption came in. Under previous law, insurance companies were subject to the corporate income tax, but were given a credit, dollar for dollar credit for the amount they paid in insurance premiums tax. And in that year, it was just simply exempt from the corporate tax. I think that someone else may be better equipped to explain why. My memory of that, though, is that it was purely an issue of the argument was one of competition with other states, that few other states imposed a corporate tax on insurance companies. Most states just had the insurance premiums tax. But that may be faulty memory on my part. But that was the logic I remember hearing at the time. The other comment I would make is just that the revenue estimate in the book actually assumes, the number there assumes you would still get the credit for insurance premiums tax. So this is actually sort of the net effect of exempting, even if you went back to the old system and gave them the credit for insurance premiums tax.
Any other questions, members? Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. Tomorrow, members, we are going to have, I believe, some members' bills, and if we can negotiate some provisions with the governor, we at least tentatively have scheduled the bill that the House passed last night. I guess we'd call it Tax Bill 1. They worked late into the morning to get it to us, so I think, you know, federal conformity is in there, and I'm told by the department that if that federal conformity for tax year 07 is going to mean anything, we probably need to get it on the governor's desk this week. Otherwise, it gets pretty late for them to get the notices out and really have much impact on taxpayers for file 07. So we have a little bit of work to do yet. I believe the governor has some heartburn over at least a couple of the provisions in the bill that was passed last night. So I'm going to have a discussion with the governor's people this afternoon, and if we can come to some agreement and can advance the bill that passed the House last night, we'd like to do that. We'd like to stay away from a conference committee for the fact that then that just drags the process out for another week, and the federal conformity probably becomes a moot point at that point. And that was one of the reasons to try and move the bill early, is to try and make sure that to the degree we could afford to, we would conform with the 06 federal changes that were made that were available for people for pay 07. So we'll be working on that this afternoon, I believe. With that, members, 8:30 tomorrow morning. This committee's adjourned.